You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a bright, beautiful, foggy Davis day. Well, foggy now. It's supposed to get sunny later today, isn't it, Don?
It's sparkling clear and beautiful here in Dixon. So the fog has been very intermittent. Erratic would be the term I would use. As we are recording this show for broadcast on January 15th, we hope. We're recording it on January 14th, 2026. The temperature right now at the University Airport, which is west of campus, is 39 degrees. And we have had significant frost every morning, at least on our farm, for the last 5 days, I think it's been. Significant visible frost. So I want to address that real quickly. The actual temperature, you know, the recorded temperature at the different weather stations that I check, has been 33, 34 degrees. So cold enough air temperature, cold enough surface temperature to get visible frost, but not really cold enough to do any injury to plants that we wouldn't expect it on. Let's put it that way. We've had a very mild winter so far. Looking out the window, I still have a couple of peppers up close to the house that are obviously still alive and still have fruit on them. Some of my tender salvias are continuing right through the winter. So we've had very little frost this year, and the frost that we've had has been visible but not harmful. So to the occasional question we're getting about needing to protect plants from frost right now with this, these clear skies, you don't need to worry about it, but do watch the temperatures. If it looks like it's going to get below 32 or 31, you might want to protect that plant. You know, you shouldn't actually be trying to grow here. Temperatures this coming week are all going to be pretty much the same. We have a very strong stationary high pressure ridge blocking any storms from us. High temperatures are going to be 61 degrees, according to the National Weather Service. Today, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, 59 degrees, Sunday, 60 degrees, Monday, which is a holiday for some, 59 degrees, and Tuesday, 58 degrees, with night temperatures actually looking around 41 to 42 because they think fog is going to form. So that's where we're at. If you get to the dew point and there's enough moisture in the air, you'll get fog. And as I drive in, I'm going through areas that are very dense fog. And other areas will be bright and sunny and perfectly clear. So drive carefully because you can hit a wall of fog very suddenly. We are going to be cold, but not freezing for the most part, and bright and sunny during the daytime, which is absolutely gorgeous. People keep asking, is it time to plant this, time to plant that? Can you do this? Can you
is
do that?
Is it time to plant tomatoes?
We'll come back to that topic in a moment. It is a great time to plant fruit trees and things like them because garden centers are receiving them all around California from the largest wholesale grower that does the fruit trees. Dave Wilson Nursery is delivering fast and furious as they can. The soil is workable. This is always our key question in January when fruit trees come in bare root, dormant, and you're supposed to go out and dig a hole 3 feet across and 18 inches down. It's roughly what you need to do for a typical bare root fruit tree. Well, if the soil that you're digging up is coming up in big globs of drippy mud, you're harming the soil. If the soil is breaking up even somewhat as you bring it up, you're fine. And in most places, we've had enough days since our last rain. The soil is nicely hydrated, but at least on my farm and most of my customers are reporting that they can dig holes correctly without getting sloppy, muddy, slick kind of situation. The problem with digging a hole in soil that's just been rained on or is too wet and has a lot of clay in it, you slick the side of the planting hole as you're digging it. And that slick side stays slick. Say that 10 times fast. That slick side stays slick and the roots can't penetrate it. So you actually are doing damage to the ultimate root structure of the tree as you do damage to the soil. If it's workable, if it's breakable, great time to find fruit trees. Probably the best selection of fruit trees in most garden centers and hardware stores around the area, all around California at this point, is right now. As we go through the bare root season, a lot of them go into containers by the end of January into February. Many nurseries now pot them up as soon as they arrive. I keep getting people asking me why other places do that. I completely understand it. Let me tell you, you have to completely reconfigure your nursery for bare root trees. You have to bring in a bunch of stuff to pile over the roots. You have to make a whole separate display. And I can tell you, having been in business since 1981, the bare root season in terms of plants staying dormant has shortened from being able to hold them till almost March 1 to having to start potting February 1. That's what's happened in my four decades in business, is the season for bare root dormancy is shortening and shortening. The last time we got in bare root roses, they were already sprouting in the cases when they came in. So there was no way to put them out bare root. That's why one of the reasons many nurseries pot them up as soon as they arrive. Minor digression there. Temperature is great right now. Soil is highly workable. I highly recommend you get out and do some gardening because it's very cheerful and sunny outside after the fog burns off.
If it's cheerful and sunny, and it hasn't rained for a week, do I have to water? Do I have to turn on my sprinklers?
There's plenty of moisture in the soil. I do have a customer who comes in every week throughout, you know, as we go into the winter and as we come out of the winter to ask me whether he needs to water his lawn. And so each week we evaluate the previous week's weather, whether he needs to run his system. We've now been several days without rain. Most grass roots are at least a foot plus deep, and so they're still able to tap into the moisture that's down there. If the grass looks fine, you really probably don't need to water. It wouldn't hurt if you've got some young grass establishing. So this was a key point I made to him and to someone else. If your lawn is just your lawn, you haven't done anything special like renovate it and overseed it or anything this fall or into the winter, then the roots are deep and the plants are probably fine, and no, you don't particularly need to irrigate. If you did overseed in, let's say, November, well, those little seedlings are still getting the roots down there. So 5 to 10 minutes with your sprinkler every couple of days for the young grass seedlings would be helpful to them. The older, mature grass plants, it doesn't matter. Also, we're getting back to a time, beginning of February typically, but some people might want to do it now with sunny, unusually warm days ahead. Throw some more seed out there. Okay, well, then if you do that, you better water daily if it's not raining or foggy. Other than that, no, except things you've newly planted may need to be watered. And of course, containers and those things that are under overhangs that did not get the rainfall. Things newly planted, I put in a bunch of things 4 or 5 weeks ago, and I haven't had to water any of them since putting them in. I'll be going out to check them today. I don't think they're going to need it today, but I do check them. What's our rule here at the Davis Garden Show?
Check daily, water as needed.
Right. So I'll check them daily, which can be a little hard to do when it's freezing, raining, or foggy. But I do go out and I check them just to make sure they're, you know, still there. Gophers haven't found them. Maybe might need some water. And I water as needed. Well, they haven't needed it yet. So we're maybe another few days like this where we're maybe 55, 60 degrees. Or if the north wind kicks in, you might want to water those individual plants. You don't need to run your whole system just to water a new tree that you put back in the corner of your yard.
So, Don, I have a question. This is brought up from last week's discussion about pruning and the difference between vase pruning and what you call yours?
Modified central leader pruning, yes.
Okay. So when the class is going to be taught by the UC Yolo County Master Gardeners, mm-hmm. are they going to teach vase pruning or modified central leader pruning?
Oh, I don't know. That's a good question. Bonnie Berman, you want to weigh in on that? Send us an email at davisgardenshow@gmail.com. Typically, the focus is on vase or open center pruning, training, and then pruning with that structure, that particular training form. I hope they'll mention modified central leader training because I have a bias for that in particular. It doesn't really change how you prune those trees once they're established. You need to know, as we've discussed in previous shows, where they fruit, how long the fruiting wood lives, and so on. So that will be the same regardless of the training technique. But just a reminder, there are two main training techniques out there for young fruit trees: open center or vase training, and modified central leader. Each has advantages, each has disadvantages. So hopefully they'll go over that, but I suspect this PSA that you're alluding to that we'll mention in a moment is more about pruning at this time of year and, you know, what the important principles are. Do you have that in front of you, by the way?
I
As long as
do. That's
okay.
why I had that question.
Great segue.
There's a free gardening class. It's called Fruit Tree Care and Maintenance, Ensuring the Health and Productivity of Backyard Fruit Trees. And this is by Yolo County UC Master Gardener Bonnie Berman, as you knew that. And it's going to be held Saturday, January 31st from 10 to 11:30 a.m. And it's at Now, it's going to be, I don't know if you all know, but the Hannah and Herbert Bauer Memorial Community Garden exists in Woodland, and it's at 137 North Cottonwood Street in Woodland. And because they're not sure whether it's going to be cold and wet and rainy or what, they're holding this in the building right next door. So this is the Bauer building right next door to the garden there. And January 31st, 10 to 11:30 a.m. There you go.
Yeah, Bonnie does a great job, and there's lots to talk about, though, as we've tried to do here on the show, where they fruit, how to avoid limb breakage, fruit thinning, whether you're going to spray for preventing any pests or diseases, all of that. It's all something to cover in an hour and a half. I would
That's a lot.
like That's a lot. Yes, indeed.
That's a lot.
But hands-on is great. I mean, we can talk about it on the radio, and I can look at pictures with customers. Just yesterday, guy brought in, as I say, bring in your pictures, especially folks who are doing their own pruning. Silhouette type pictures are great, especially on a foggy day. That's a great day to take pictures of fruit trees for pruning advice because you get the strong contrast. So he brought in a picture of his apricot, pluot, plum, nectarine, and I just took a Sharpie. He printed them out full color on a single page of paper each, and I just went blip, blip, blip. Here's what I would do, and I explained why. And in 10 minutes, he had a quick tutorial on how to prune four trees.
Wonderful.
A little fast to go over that, and a two-dimensional format has some drawbacks. So I think a hands-on pruning seminar is a fantastic thing to go to, especially if you're fairly new at backyard orchard culture.
Now, usually we make an announcement about KDRT and what to see and where to go to donate and all that stuff. But KDRT is in the in the process of transitioning their website. Now, there's a few problems there. Anyway, it's not there. So if you go to the website, you will not be able to push the donate button until the website comes back up. So you'll just have to hold on to your money until then.
curb your enthusiasm until the station is
Now
back, and then go to kdrt.org and click on the support button.
and the radio station is still broadcasting. So if you turn it on, you'll hear it, but you aren't going to be able to delve into the details.
That's not
Oh,
yet.
by the way, if you need a past show of ours, even with the website down, we have our own domain that we've been archiving our shows at forever, and it's called davisgardenshow.com.
Yeah, so if you think you might have missed a show for one reason or another, you can always find it there. And I do try to put at least a brief summary of the topics there.
Oh, he's
Okay.
really bad about that.
I'm very bad about it.
I
Yes, I am very bad about that. Okay, we
really
had.
wish one of our listeners would start doing the descriptions. Okay. Hey, Don, we've got mail. Should I
Yes,
do a
indeed.
mail?
Let's go to the, let's see, a couple different questions here. Go
Let's
ahead.
try Melissa.
Okay.
Okay. And Melissa's in Glendale, California. Now, where again is Glendale? That sounds south, isn't it?
Southern California.
Okay.
Yes.
Hi, Lois and Don. A few shows back, Don mentioned that he had assistants who did a quick chop of rose shrubs, which ended up performing as well as the meticulously pruned ones. I would like to experiment with this, especially if it will save me time with this winter chore. I have hybrid tea roses. Can you offer any tips? Should I defoliate? Should I swap out my bypass pruners for large head shears? Maybe a machete? How about a lightsaber? With much
Lightsaber
appreciating
would
to
be
your gardening wisdom, Melissa.
so yes, a lightsaber would be perfect. Nice clean cut that way. This went way back to when I had a kid and friends of that kid, and these are teenagers, older teenagers who wanted to earn some money and help out around the farm. Believe it or not, those types of kids actually exist. And I was looking at that time, I had 50 or 60 roses in one big bed area, and it was getting late in the season. I hadn't pruned them. And so I said, okay, you guys can prune the roses. And they, their eyes
They
went wide.
freak.
Yeah. Oh my
Yeah.
God. No, we don't know how to prune roses. I said, no, don't worry about this. Cut them in half. just cut them in half. Take your loppers is what we used. They did have hand pruners, but loppers with about a 16-inch handle turned out to be great because then you're not right in the thorns. And I said, just go straight across. Just cut them straight across. Don't worry about where exactly you're cutting. I said, I'll come back later and clean that up. You're just basically reducing each plant by half and, really important, hauling all that stuff away and getting it out of my way. The theory was I would go back in there, thin them out, choose the canes, do that, cut to the ankle, blah, blah, blah. Well, it never happened. No, I was too busy that season. So I said, all right, we'll just see what happens. I knew it wasn't the end of the world. There are roses that go unpruned in people's yards and they give perfectly good results. So they all sprouted out. They all flushed out very vigorously and they bloomed better than I remembered. I mean, it was a great bloom that year. I later read about a study in England. This was it sounded like the Royal Rose Society or something like that. I have all the information saved, but this was from the 1990s, where they had done three ways of pruning. One was a traditional thin chooser canes, cut to an outside bud, blah, blah, blah. The second was what I just described. Take loppers or pruners and cut, make clean cuts and just go straight across. Just cut them in half, roughly. If they were a 6-foot rose, you cut them to 3 feet. If they were a little 3-foot rose, you cut them to 18 inches. The guys were great at that, by the way. That was really easy to explain. And they felt perfectly comfortable knowing that they couldn't do any harm. That was the key thing. They weren't going to harm them by doing this. And then the other method that they tested in this UK rose garden was head shears. They literally took head shears and cut many of them in half with head shears. Now you can imagine that's shredding the end.
What's the difference between a lopper and a head shear?
Well, the quality of the cut is the biggest thing. A lopper, you're making an individual cut and it's clean because it's like scissors.
Like scissors, yeah.
Head shears are going tearing up the wood as they go through. So there's
those things with the teeth that shred back and forth.
Exactly. And so you can imagine that this left a rather torn end and all that kind of thing. But that's all they did. This was a test to see whether that would work. And interestingly, the half cut, in other words, cut in half, and the head shear cut rose bushes gave more blooms, more vigor, looked better than the ones that were pruned by the careful, methodical Royal Rose Society checklist that we all know of, you know, select 6 canes and cut all that kind of stuff. So the gist of it was, simply cutting them back gave better results in terms of the number of blooms, at least. Now, we don't have full data on how it affected the disease load or anything like that. But it did suggest that you don't absolutely have to do this methodical pruning technique, checklist pruning technique that the American Rose Society and other rose organizations put out there. It depends on what your goal is. If your goal is simply size control and kind of reduce the number of fungal spores that are carrying over the winter and that's it, cutting it in half or even using a head shear, I haven't tested that one, even using a head shear is fine. If your goal is long stem, perfect roses with perfect foliage on a plant that's fairly open, so it tends to resist disease better, depending on where you're listening, that could be an important factor, then you would use the old fashioned checklist technique. But it literally was, to answer your question, a straight across pruning. I preferred loppers and pruners because they make a clean cut. Other than that, a machete would probably be fine. A lightsaber would be even better if you could get a hold of one. But the idea is you're simply cutting them in half. And so at one point, I wrote an article a long time ago, Rose Pruning is Easy. I think that's on redwoodbarn.com. I'm not sure. And it basically was cut them in half, thin them out. That's it. So the thin them out part is the part I haven't described yet. It's just where you go back when you've done all the 50% pruning and you take your hand pruners and just cut out the crossing branches or things that are obviously making a denser, more crowded plant, if you have time. But I didn't do that year. Taking off the foliage is one of those incredibly tedious things that I certainly, 50 roses, 70 roses, are you going to go out and strip all the leaves off? Of course you're not going to. So I've never done that. But if you want to, it would, at least in theory, reduce the amount of overwintering fungal spores of powdery mildew, possibly downy mildew, possibly rust.
What about if you took one of those house washing hoses, the really strong
pressure washer?
Pressure washer. Yeah. Sure. What if you took that to it? That would That would blast everything off, might blast leaves off.
It would blast the spores into different places in your garden. Whether that would take them.
Well, if they only grow on roses, who cares?
Well, that could be, yes. My experience has been that diseases on roses are more a varietal thing. If you've got a rose that routinely gets powdery mildew, it's going to get powdery mildew, even if you strip all the leaves off, I assume, even if you prune it hard. If it's susceptible to powdery mildew, it's going to be a problem, but there's plenty of roses that are resistant to powdery mildew. Downy mildew doesn't seem to have any susceptibility or resistance factor except the density of the plant. So in my experience, downy mildew, which many people here mistakenly think is black spot of roses, downy mildew is the first disease that hits. It gets spots on the leaves, which then spread into the veins, that's an important point, and into the petiole. It defoliates the plant. But my experience with it is when we have a wet spring, typically wet late winter and early spring, you get a lot of it. It shows up on the overgrown climber down at the end, or miniature roses were a real problem with it when it first came into California in the 1990s. Downy mildew has not always been with us. It would spread from them to nearby roses very quickly if your roses are really close together. So my new rose garden that I designed a few years back, my roses are all 6 to 8 feet apart. If I get downy mildew on one plant, well, that gets it. That's not great, but it doesn't immediately spread down the row to all the others. So that makes more difference in my experience with that disease than any hard pruning and leaf removal. And finally, rust, which is really ugly. Everybody's probably had it at one time or another. The orange spots on the bottom of the leaf, that's almost always related to how you're irrigating, has been our experience here. It's a heavy spore. It has to splash upward on the plant. So that only happens if there's heavy rainfall during a period of vigorous growth, or you have lawn sprinklers spraying towards the plant. So adjusting your irrigation can significantly reduce rust. I don't think stripping all the leaves off is necessary. I find it incredibly tedious. It probably helps marginally, but in my experience and some training in plant pathology, the number of spores that overwinter is less important for any pest that has an exponential population increase under favorable conditions than how long you exist in that favorable conditions period. So it's the rain, it's the moisture, it's the proximity, it's the density. It's not the number of leaves that carried spores over, in my opinion. What matters more is getting some good airflow through there or around the plant, and just choosing varieties that are resistant in the case of powdery mildew.
So I want to come back a little bit to pruning. Now, I used to have some roses in the yard. They're all gone. I have no idea what happened to them, but they're
too shaded, most likely.
Probably, yeah. So I got a rose on your recommendation, and I was going to plant it in underneath the redwoods. Mm-hmm. Now, you heard that phrase, was going to plant it. Mm-hmm. Well, I couldn't make a hole. The roots are so dense.
Roots of redwoods are pretty competitive. Yeah.
So it is sitting in a large pot, not as big as a barrel, but a large pot out behind my door. I could see it if the drapes were open. And it's just sitting in a pot and it's growing. Now, the first year it had cottony stuff.
Cottony cushion scale. Yep.
It came with that, I'm pretty sure. But anyway, I got rid of that. And then the next year and the next, now, at this point, I haven't pruned it. Mm-hmm. And it's like, so the wood that I would be pruning is like 3 or 4 years old. Mm-hmm. Do you do anything different when you're pruning old wood than when you're pruning new wood?
Well, it just isn't going to bloom. The old wood isn't going to bloom. So your pruning is to get new wood at eye level. That's really one of the main purposes of pruning, is to keep the blooms, you know, where you can see them. I have plenty of roses that I never prune. They're great big plants. My peace rose is a good example. I've left it unpruned for 6 years now. It's 9 feet tall. Okay. It gives me 50 blooms all at once, but they're way up there. So this year I'm probably going to take it back for the first time. I was just curious to see how big it would get. It's a great landscape plant, but there's no flowers below 6 feet. So that one we will be pruning mainly for size control. That's really one of the main purposes of pruning modern roses, hybrid teas and grandifloras. In our climate, would get 5, 6, 7 feet tall, and most people don't want them that tall. My grandfather methodically pruned his roses to 42 inches because, as we like to joke, my grandmother was 60 inches. So she could walk up to the blooms. They'd be at her eye level. She could cut them. He wanted to keep them down, you know, at human scale. There are many roses floribundas, for example, that you don't have to prune at all if you don't want to. You can grow them as hedges. You can grow them as landscape shrubs. And we've gone over this many times. It's the hybrid teas that drive all the pruning discussions. And I'd like to get away from that. It's like you should have, let's say you're doing a rose pruning seminar. You should be, how many of you are here just for long stem cutting roses? All right, you go over to that table. Then the rest of us who have really interesting roses, we'll talk about how to prune hybrid musk roses, floribunda roses, miniature roses, climbing roses, true climbing roses, grand of, you know, David Austin roses and so forth. They would all be, could all be handled somewhat differently. And I do, again, as I say over and over, don't worry about it, folks. Roses are very forgiving. Okay. As garden and landscape plants, they're very, very forgiving of hard pruning, light pruning, you name it.
So you said you had that rose that's 9 feet tall. Now, if you cut that down to 4 feet, you're not going to get any flowers. You said there were no flower buds. Does that mean it's just going to die, or is it going to
put out sunshine? No. When I cut it back to 4 feet, I'm intending to rejuvenate it by getting new canes coming up from the base.
So the canes will
flower. It will flower this year. It doesn't affect that. We will have fewer blooms on it in that first spring bloom than I'll have if I leave it 9 feet tall. But I'll be able to cut them. they'll be at human level. So,
and by next year, you'll have as many flowers as you had before.
Oh, by midsummer, I'll have as many flowers as I had before. Okay. And it'll be it'll be 6 feet tall. If you've ever grown peace or Chicago peace, it's a pretty tall rose. When I started this project 8 years ago to start growing more of our roses for sale at my nursery, I was really tired of the availability problems on good quality, interesting roses that aren't just long stem hybrid teas. So I planted a whole bunch of roses to have stock plants. And many of them, I don't prune much at all because I'm just growing them for cutting material. So cutting material meaning to take in and propagate. So I'm just cutting them back any time of year. We now root roses year round. We have found with a greenhouse operation that we have, and this is really simple, folks. You can do this too. We just have the equivalent of a mist bench, and we have the equivalent, and we have a heat bench out there, heating pad. We're taking cuttings now. We take cuttings midsummer. We take cuttings anytime. Anytime someone brings us an interesting rose that I know is non-patent, we go ahead and make it into a cutting if it's something I want to put into our program. Many of my roses I'm growing for that purpose. So I've been going out cutting off 16-inch shoots for propagation. And I'm looking at the plant, well, that looks great. The plant looks fine that way, especially the floribundas and especially the grandifloras. But it's true for some of the hybrid teas as well. If you're not comfortable trying to make these value judgments from one variety to the next, cut them in half. There you go.
All right. So from the mailbag, we have Emily in Monterey Peninsula, half a mile from the ocean. And she writes, do you have recommendations to make an edible hedgerow tall enough to be a privacy screen?
Yeah.
My neighbor has a row of Pacific wax myrtles they plan to remove in a year or so along our shared fence. So I would like to create a privacy screen on my side. And she sent a picture. It's in the backyard. The fence is between the two backyards. So it's not next to the house or anything.
Yeah.
The site information, lots of coastal fog, low chill, sandy soil, close to my 200-year-old coastal live oak on the left of the picture. Gets afternoon sun when the fog burns off, but we'll get shade from the Pacific Max myrtles to their south while they are establishing. Things I'm looking for: mixed species, something edible, nothing toxic to my toddler who might pick it, no summer watering near the oak root tree.
Okay.
I was thinking Western serviceberry maybe and bay laurel or elderberry if my toddler were older. Any other ideas? Thank you. And thank you so much for following up from prior week's questions. When you have more thoughts and research, you always say, I hope this listener is listening this week. And I always am. Thank you.
Okay. Now, this is a great one. What a wonderful gardening climate that is. I mean, I grew up in coastal Southern California where you have fog every morning until noon, and then it burns off and it's sunny in the afternoon. Then it comes back in at sunset. So it's always mild. I was within hearing distance of the ocean practically. So there are many, many, many plants that work very well in that climate. It is a little more challenging for edibles, I will say. One of the things I quickly learned moving to the Sacramento Valley is that here we can grow so many kinds of fruit trees and edible things because we have the heat and we have the chilling and so forth. So some of the plants I'm going to suggest or mention might be more appropriate to interior gardeners. Monterey is Sunset Zone 17. Your questions were edibles and privacy and not watering. First of all, with regard to the not watering, you're in a mild climate, so you can get away with that. It wouldn't hurt plants planted along this fence to have a drip irrigation line going near them, watering them. That's not going to hurt your oak tree. But for the edible hedgerow, I decided to do my fun thought exercise, which is just off the top of my head. Not sit down and make a full design. These are just off the top of my head. Some might work for you, some might not. The first thing that occurred to me, interestingly, was Arbutus unido. Arbutus unido is the strawberry tree. I would do the dwarf forms, not the 25-foot version.
Fruit is that edible?
Yeah, sure it is. Yeah, it's edible. People who are into exotic and weird fruit tell me that Arbutus unido fruit is edible. And I said, well, I've tried them a couple of times. They weren't very good. And they reply, oh, you have to just keep trying until you get a good one. Key being, you know, kid picks one up to eat it. This is fine. It's also a very attractive plant. And I would probably look for Elfin King or Compacta rather than the full-size tree. This is related to our native Madrone, but it's much, much, much less fussy. If you want to try Madrone, if that grows in your area, ask locally. I don't think it does, but these are reliable and they have a similar attractive bark. They're evergreen. The flowers attract hummingbirds and they flower practically year-round and the fruit technically is edible.
Okay, before we
Compacta, Elfin King, Oktoberfest are the three dwarf varieties of Arbutus unido that'd probably be best in this situation.
She's looking for something to screen.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so it will.
If you're saying dwarf, how yeah, my is dwarf?
My dwarf Oktoberfest is 8 feet tall.
Oh, so
it
okay.
grows pretty.
And how dense is it, and is it evergreen?
Solid wall of foliage, and it is evergreen. In fact, it's one where you'll want to prune it up a little bit to expose the trunk because it's the same color as Madrone, so it's very attractive. So that's one possibility. And the fruit is technically edible, although it's going to be more for wildlife than for you, probably. Second thing I wrote down was ribes. Now, these are more for wildlife than for people, but the fruit is edible. And the one that I've had really good results with, bearing in mind this one is deciduous, is Ribes aureum, the golden currant, which is native in California. And mine has spread to form quite a thicket. So I want to put the possible downside in there, you know, right at the start of the discussion. It has taken everything on my property. This is a plant that was in an irrigated area when it first went in. It's been in the shade of a fig tree. I then removed the fig tree. Then the fig tree came back. There was a walnut nearby, totally unfazed by the walnut. The walnut had to be taken out because of a disease problem. So then it was in full sun. We had a litter of puppies in that yard. So there were nine puppies that trashed the entire yard. And the Ribes aureum came back just fine. So it's golden currant. It has a beautiful yellow flower and a fruit that starts yellow but actually dark. Darkens and is tannic, astringent, but edible. And it does have a distinctive flavor. So if you see your kid eating a Ribes, it's absolutely fine. But
how tall?
6 foot to 8 foot, depending on moisture, more than anything. So if you want it to get bigger, you're going to want to irrigate it. Because as we've noted many times with Ribes on this show, if you don't water them in the summer, they'll drop their leaves in the summer, which would not be a very desirable characteristic. But with just in Monterey Peninsula, just once every 2 to 4 weeks watering, they'd probably be fine. You'd have to think about that one because it is deciduous and it does spread. The next one I thought of because of Ribes was Mahonia. Berberis is the genus they're now put in. Mahonia aquifolium is our native or California native, sometimes called Oregon grape, which is one of those names that just couldn't be worse as a common name. It is native to California and it's not a grape, but it has a fruit that looks a little bit like a grape. I've eaten them. And again, tannic, astringent, some flavor there. Birds would certainly like them. They bloom in the midwinter, which is really cool. So this is one nice thing about all the Mahonias, native or non-native, is that they tend to bloom December, January, February, depending on the variety, and they're bright yellow. So that's a nice, nice bonus. At least here they do that. And there are some hybrids, non-native hybrids, that get big. These are prickly plants. If you want a barrier plant that you don't want anyone to go through, but Mahonia is certainly a possibility.
How tall?
Well, that varies quite a bit. Aquifolium compacta only gets about 4 feet. Regular aquifolium, 6 to 7 feet. And there are hybrid Mahonias and Mahonias from Asia that get 7 to 10 feet. I have Mahonia lomariifolia on my property, and it's 12 feet tall and in full bloom right now in January. It's also one of the spiniest plants I own. So plant these with caution. Just be aware that all the leaves are spiny, so it can be a little uncomfortable to get through. I suddenly thought, you know, I grew up in this climate, more or less, a little bit warmer. What were the plants my parents planted around our place in San Diego that would meet these criteria? Well, my mother had a feijoa, pineapple guava, did great. She trained it up like a tree, but you don't have to do that. It's actually a great shrub. In milder climates where you don't have the heat, it's not going to be real sweet. But you don't necessarily expect that with a pineapple guava. And we got a lot of fruit. Mom made chutney from it, and it was very good. And we would eat them right off the plant. The flowers are delicious,
Yes.
interestingly. The flowers are fleshy, showy, and taste great. They're very sweet. So, and kids love to eat the flowers once you train them that they're edible. But the fruit is very tasty. If you definitely want them for the fruit, go and buy one that's a labeled cultivar, Coolidge, Nazamet. There's a bunch of them out there. They're harder to find because they have to be grafted. If you just go to a nursery and buy a Feijoa siloiana, pineapple guava, if you go to a nursery to buy one, it doesn't have a name like that on it. It doesn't have Coolidge or Nazamet or some cultivar name. Then it was grown from seed. It may or may not have good fruit. Could be very good, could be boring, could be non-existent. So there's a risk you take when you just buy the seed-grown ones. But in any event, they flower. And in any event, the flowers are edible, and it's a great evergreen plant for privacy. The other things,
And it will get tall if you let it.
yeah, she trained hers up like a tree, and it was about 12 feet tall. You can prune them back like a 6 to 8 foot shrub with no problem. I have one that's over 10 feet because I've never pruned it, and I've had it for quite a long time. It produces a couple hundred fruit every year. And that's a lot of feijoas. So a factor in this edible thing is the fruit litter. Be aware of that.
And factor in, do you have squirrels?
Oh,
We've
they'll
had
love
Fajira
them.
outside our house, and about 5 years ago, the squirrels discovered them,
Yeah.
and now I don't get any fruit at all.
Well, we need to mention that with any edible landscaping, whether you're doing a food forest, as they call them, or an edible hedge or something like this. You won't be the only one that likes all that fruit that's in there and the density and the cover that it's providing. So tree squirrels can be a problem. That's just going to go with the territory, unfortunately. The other thing we had two other plants that are possibilities for you. We had a loquat. Mother loved her loquat tree. She had gone out and purchased a cultivar, an actual selected form that was selected for the fruit called champagne. There's another one called, I think, Gold Nugget. One of my neighbors had one of those. Loquats are evergreen. They have big, bold, tropical-looking leaves. They get the one we had in our yard was 15 to 20 feet, but that was because we allowed that. You don't have to allow it to get that big. They produce a very, 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 very large amount of fruit. It's a strong flavored, acidic, but sweet fruit, and you have to use it right away. This is the important thing. It doesn't hold. It's in the apple group of the rose family. When you break into it, it oxidizes right away and turns brown. So loquats are great, but they're big. So that would be something to put at one end or the other. It's okay to prune them, but you probably just do more strategic pruning on them and just give it 10 to 12 feet of space to grow. And you do need to be aware that loquats are susceptible to bacterial fire blight, just as the apples and pears to which they're related are. So that can happen. I've seen it happen. You have to prune it out right away. The other thing we had in our yard down there, and I have one here, and we do sell them in the valley as well, just barely hard to hear, is true guavas. Guavas that you think of as being from the tropics or Hawaii or something like that. The genus is Psidium with a P, Psidium. There's the strawberry guava, the lemon guava, and the tropical guava. And those are all in that same genus, different species in the case of the tropical versus the others. Years ago, I wrote an article which I said you can grow the strawberry and the lemon guava here, but not the tropical guava, and promptly got a letter or an email from someone who said, just so you know, Mr. Shore, I have one in my backyard and I'm in Fresno. Okay, well, that's great. That's interesting to know. I had a grower in Modesto who started propagating tropical guavas, and we'd bring them in and we held them through the winter a couple of times. They showed no injury whatsoever in our nursery. So apparently, even the tropical guava is hardy in the interior. The strawberry and lemon guavas, which are beautiful trees, are hardy in the interior. Just on the edge, but they're hardy here and they do great in the coastal zones. They produce a very good, although rather acidic fruit. They have a bark like a crepe myrtle and they have a beautiful form. So, this is another one like the arbutus where you'll probably want to prune it up a little bit to feature the appearance and the attractive bark of the plant. But guavas are actually a possibility for you as well. And here's the problem with living on the coast: it's not enough heat to get the sugar content for a lot of fruit. So this also applies to citrus, and we'll talk about them in a moment. I do want to throw in one other thing my parents had. Now, you want to be careful where you plant this, but they made great use of it, which was a prickly pear cactus. One, they're extremely easy to grow. All you need is one of the pads from someone who has one, let it scar over, stick that in the ground, you'll have one. Better give it about a 20 by 20 area. That's what mine has taken up. The fruit is edible. You do, of course, need to remove the spines from the fruit before you eat it. The pads are eaten. Those are nopales. The pads are eaten as they're first coming out. The tender new growth is used in Mexican cooking. So it's easy. It does grow on the coast. It's the flavor is mild and sweet. There's no acidity to the fruit of a prickly pear cactus. Be aware of how big they get, but they are certainly a possibility for a privacy screen.
Well, I think, and you're going to have to correct me on this, I think that there is a spineless version of prickly pear cactus. No, seriously, I have seen that plant.
Yes, you think there is, because Luther Burbank, probably the most famous horticulturist in the world, spent much of his career trying to develop or find a spineless prickly pear. I knew a guy who tried to track them down. He wrote a book about it. He was active in the Bamboo Society, but this was his other passion, was this curious story of the prickly pear cactus that didn't have spines. Mutations occur where there are fewer spines. It is known that when people would come to visit, Burbank would have removed the spines from the plant that was in his display garden. So he was a little bit of a huckster at times. But the point is that there's no evidence of an actual spineless prickly pear, but there are some that are sufficiently reduced that we go ahead and put that on the label. It doesn't really matter. Here's the thing. They're not painful. It's not a plant. It's not like having a giant agave out there. It's a cactus. You know it has spines. You're generally careful around it. I never got injured by that one of the many pokey things in my mom's cactus garden. So prickly pears would be the least of my concern in that regard. And they're very attractive. The flowers are utterly beautiful. Big, showy flowers that are very attractive to all kinds of pollinators, including birds of various types. And the fruit's very attractive. And all the fruit on mine along the county road gets harvested by people who know what they're doing. They take it home and they make use of it. So it's a possibility. Didn't want to give it too much promotion here because this is a giant plant. It is a cactus, but they certainly
is it dense enough to be a screen?
Oh, yes. Yes. It's a solid wall of cactusness.
What about citrus?
Yeah, that's the group I'd like to focus on a little bit, because here in the valley, if you came in and said you wanted a hedge and you wanted it to be edible, I would steer you towards citrus. They do need irrigation, but once established for home gardeners, they're surprisingly drought tolerant. The problem is in the coastal zones, you don't get hot enough to get the sugar content for most of them, and you don't get cold enough in the winter to initiate the conversion of the acidity to a less acid flavor profile. And so you tend to get much tartar fruit. It tends not to color up real well. So there's citrus I wouldn't do. I gave my father in coastal San Diego a Satsuma mandarin at one point, and he grew it. It grew fine. It would certainly fulfill your hedge requirement. And it flowered and it set fruit. And he was really thrilled. And the fruit never turned color and never sweetened because it never got cold enough to initiate that part of the process. So mandarins would not be my first choice. In coastal zones, you plant the high acid citrus that you expect to be tart. So lemons and limes, for example, will generally do well. Lemons are big. A lemon tree is a 15 foot plus, almost no matter what you do. And you want thorny. There's a thorny plant. Limes are generally more like giant shrubs, bear slime or the Mexican lime. You could probably do either of them there because you don't get cold enough to damage the Mexican or key lime. But they're a fairly rangy plant. My experience has been they kind of go out and they're fairly open. So to get the density, you would probably need to do some clipping and shaping, but you could probably get limed and they would be perfectly good. You aren't counting on a lime being sweet. You certainly get the zest, you get the aroma, you get all the characteristics you're growing them for. And there are things that are called limes that aren't. Is an interesting group to look at. They're technically sour oranges that are used like limes. And here, again, we don't care how sweet they are. So the flavor will be there. They'll just be more acidic than they would be if they were in the valley, but they will give you good flavor and good results. In particular, one that's called the Rangpur lime, which is a sour mandarin or sour orange, apparently. That one is a good one and will produce very heavily for most people. Looks a lot like a Meyer lemon in its growth habit. And in fact, the fruit colors up much like a Meyer lemon, but it's a different plant. And it's called Rangpur lime because it's used as if it were a lime. In other words, you're using the juice for its flavoring rather than eating it out of hand. Other sour oranges include Calamondin, calamansi, it's called in the Philippines. It's a small, round, orange fruit, smaller than a lime, but used the same way, and quite delicious and very productive. And they're very attractive plants. I mean, so in terms of your hedge potential, they'll do that, and the fruit will just be a nice bonus. And bear in mind that citrus, even if they don't set a lot of fruit or if the fruit isn't super high quality, the flowers are fragrant and wonderful, and bees love them. So they're very attractive plants to add. And the calamondin and the Rangpur lime and the other things like them, the fruit hangs on. So it's got fruit on it basically year round, at least in theory, getting sweeter. So those are a couple of possibilities, the Rangpur lime and the calamondin and some other sour oranges in that category. Kumquats actually will grow fine and produce well. They're very tart. They'll be even more tart along the coast, but they're very, very attractive plants. And they bloom later than the other citrus. And again, the fruit hangs on year round. So in the valley, I'd be focusing heavily on citrus because they would be the classic edible hedge plant for us. In your case, just consider a couple of these, see how they do. Bear in mind the different growth habits and see which ones will work in your mixed hedge planting. But there is a group that you might want to look at in this low acid citrus group called limetas, sweet lime. They're acidless limes. My first customers years ago that asked about these were either from Israel or Palestine or sometimes from Pakistan or India. And then in Mexico, these are very popular. I actually, when I was a kid, we used to travel in Baja California quite a bit. We would drive down the freeway, went from Tijuana to Ensenada. That's where it ended. We were in a four-wheel drive vehicle and we'd go driving off into the middle of nowhere. When you're a kid of a geologist, you go to some pretty funny places for summer vacation. But one of the things that would happen is we would come to these small towns, small cities, and there would be street vendors juicing this amazing lime and just handing us a glass, paper cup of it right from the juicer. So we knew it was safe and we knew exactly what it was. And it was remarkably aromatic, amazing flavor, one of the most delicious citrus that I can remember. And I was probably like 8 years old at that time. And I still remember all these years later, limetas, low acid limes. These are sometimes sold in garden centers. I know that Four Winds Growers, which is in the Bay Area, does grow and sell them at times. So if your local garden center orders from Four Winds, they can probably get them, or you can order directly from them in their online store. Limetas, lower acid limes like that. Yeah, they're not truly, they're naturally occurring mutation of a lime that's very low acidity. This happens with citrus occasionally, and it catches on for fresh use. They're milder flavored than any other citrus. They're not going to be something with a real intense flavor, but they're great for just juicing and using right away. So the limetas are worth considering as well.
So you said something about some of these citrus that they hung on the tree and they
Yeah.
never ripened up.
Yep.
Now, are citrus climacteric? Can we bring those inside and put them in the chill box for a day and bring
No.
them out and anything we can do?
Technically, no. They're not like a peach or a tomato where there's a ripening process that's not only predictable but leads to a better outcome. They do change a little bit when they're harvested. So, if any of you have seen the sumo mandarin in the grocery store, those giant mandarins that came on the market 10 or 15 years ago, and they peel really easily and they're enormous, they're like double the size of a Satsuma mandarin. Part of their marketing of that one was that they found that if they picked these and held on to them for about 3 weeks before sending them to market, the sugar content would measurably increase. So let's say that a mandarin is 11 Brix. That's a measure of sweetness or soluble solids anyway. If it's 11, if you took the sumo and held it for 2 or 3 weeks, it would be 12 or 13. So they could say that they were sweeter. In fact, they could say they were the sweetest mandarins on the market. So that was part of the marketing, was to pick them, hold them under cool conditions. My guess, and the guess of people who are more educated than I, is that all that was reflecting was the slight desiccation of the fruit. In other words, it's losing moisture. And so the sugar content is just increasing by mere concentration in the fruit. That's not really a climacteric fruit where it goes through a full ripening process, a metabolic process like peaches do and tomatoes do. But they do get a little sweeter after you pick them. So if you are picking them, they're only as far as we can tell, 1 degree Brix, but might make a difference. More to the point, they store fine. So you pick them, pick a bunch, keep them on the counter, eat one each day, see if you like the flavor better. Mandarins are not going to be your best choice in general because mandarins really do need heat for sugar and cooling for low to reduce the acidity. But there are some that are low acid, like pixie has come back on the market. Pixie's a cool little small fruited mandarin. Hangs on the tree for weeks and weeks and weeks. I mean, you supposedly start picking them in February, but people who go out and sample and have fruit on their tree in the summer find that they're perfectly fine. It's a mild flavored citrus to begin with. So it's nothing exciting, but it's great. You know, it's good. Kids like them. They peel easily. They're naturally fairly seedless and they're sweet. They're not sweet tart. They're just sweet. So if I were choosing a mandarin to try and didn't really care for sure about the outcome, knowing full well that 3-4 years down the road, I might say, oh, this is kind of boring, I would try Pixie. That would be one that I would certainly consider. It probably would get enough heat to at least give you reasonable flavor, and you wouldn't have the acidity being overwhelming as it would be on any of the other mandarins. My father's experience was the Satsuma that I gave him. The flavor was great, but it was so tart that he ended up using it, mixing it with other things, you know, mixed drinks, that kind of thing. Just eating them right off the tree was not very satisfactory.
So let's get back to the original question.
Yeah.
You were saying, I was thinking of Western Serviceberry and Bay Laurel. Now, what is Western Serviceberry?
Amelanchier, I get people asking about it periodically, and I don't think of it as a plant that we can do in the valley at all. I'm pulling up my Western Garden book. By the way, this is still a good starting point for a lot of these things. And they are listing Amelanchier or Serviceberry or Shadblow or Juneberry for zones 1 through 6.
Oh,
so those are cold mountain zones.
Yeah.
It doesn't say anything about the coastal zone. So I don't honestly know whether it's going to get what it needs to do well for you there. It's something that would be, it would be an experiment. Probably would grow. I don't know if it would flower or fruit real well. And Bay Laurel, well, Bay Laurel grows anywhere.
But Bay Laurel hasn't got fruit, does it?
No, we're not talking, it's edible. I mean, you can use the leaves in cooking. And then Bay Laurel is probably safer to try and find at a local nursery in your area than the California Bay, because the California Bay is a known host for sudden oak death. And so a lot of nurseries just don't grow it. Doesn't mean you couldn't buy it and plant it. It just means you can have trouble finding it. Whereas Laurus nobilis grows fine and it's a very tough plant. Now, bear in mind, if you do nothing, it will get 20 to 30 feet with no problem. Very upright, strongly upright growth habit. The biggest one I know of was just taken out a year or two ago over on Plum Lane. It was 60 plus years old and it was probably 40 to 50 feet tall. It was an incredibly impressive Bay Laurel tree. So they can be big, but they tend to be so upright that they don't crowd a garden, and they're absolutely as prunable as you can want. I mean, you can keep them in a container, clip them hard, you stick them in the ground, prune it like a hedge, or just let it turn into this big, really upright tree. So they would certainly, Laurus nobilis, Bay Laurel would fit in this situation.
And then what is wrong with elderberry? She said, or elderberry if my toddler were older.
Well, they're poisonous.
Is elderberry messy?
No, it's poisonous.
Forget that.
Well, once the kid's a little older, you can go through this. This is why we don't use them on school grounds or places like that. The underripe fruit is definitely going to give you a stomach ache. It has cyanide in it. The leaves have cyanide in them. The ripe fruit is fine. So you just need to wait till they're ripe. And of course, you don't eat the foliage. There was a rather famous case, and I know about it primarily because one of my customers was one of these monks. There's a Buddhist temple above Big Sur, and there are elderberries all around there. It's a very isolated area, but they can gather lots of elderberries. And they had gathered a whole bunch of the fruit. That was fine. They smashed it all up, and they're cooking it. Cooking, by the way, will take care of cyanide because it's easy to cook out. And so they had done all that, and the novitiate decided to macerate in some of the tender foliage from the plants as well. One of the monks got airlifted to the hospital. The others wished they had been. None of them died, but they were all really, really, really sick all night because of the foliage ingestion. Presumably the fruit was ripe enough, but the foliage ingestion got them all, unfortunately, good and sick. Interesting points about that. If they'd cooked it with the foliage in there, maybe they wouldn't have gotten so sick. Let's not experiment and find out the hard way. The point being, elderberries do have toxic stage and toxic parts, as well as edible fruit, of course, later in the season. So like the Toyon, some of the others, that would be something you could consider perhaps when the kid's a little more grown up. And a berry on the ground isn't going to send him to the hospital, but a stomach ache isn't much fun to have. So that's the reason I wouldn't suggest elderberries at this stage. They're beautiful plants. They are lush, tropical. I think elderberries with loquat, for example, would give a tropical look to your yard that would be unparalleled. But you might want to wait until your kids, let's say 4, okay, and they can understand a little better. Don't touch that. It's sharp. Don't eat that. It might make you sick. pretty simple rules you do need to learn early on. Apparently I did, but
you survived.
Apparently, yes.
So looking at the picture again, I notice that on the side of the fence closest to us, I can see a mesh going up there.
Yep.
Not only behind the wooden pickets of the fence, but up quite a ways, up high. Yep. And I'm wondering if that means that she might be amenable to having a trellis with some vines growing up.
Sure, vines
are there. Are evergreen vines that can, or maybe just in the summer, plant some beans or something. I don't know.
Well, there are vines that will do what you're after. The Hardenbergia is a good example, but lilac, happy wanderer, lilac vine. Covers quickly. There's nothing edible here. Covers quickly, gives really pretty flowers in the wintertime. Very vigorous vine to 15 feet or so. Our experience with them, after having sold them for 25, 30 years, is they typically last 4 or 5 years, and then they die out. Yep. So they're a short-lived vine. That can be really handy. Okay, that can be actually much better than a vine that goes crazy. Lois and I have had plenty of experience with that end of the vine spectrum. So a Hardenbergia, if you want some privacy quickly, and the shrubs set forward enough, like on the slight slope that I see here, that they wouldn't just get engulfed by the vine, that's certainly a possibility. And our native grape, Vitis californica, although deciduous, our Vitis californica grape is a very attractive plant, nice fall color. Fruit's edible, it's strong flavored, and it's got seeds, so most people just let the wildlife enjoy it. But I know Vitis californica almost certainly would grow in that area as well. Wouldn't have the sugar content, so it'd be more just for fun and nibbling here and there. But a vine is a good way to get some privacy quickly as you're waiting for the other things to grow in. And that's one particularly good use for Hardenbergia, the lilac vine. Quick filler, short term, 3-4 years in, take it out, and your shrubs are already up and giving you the privacy.
Well, I hope that we have given you enough things to think about, Emily, that you're, well, your head is probably spinning at this point. but tell us what you finally decide. And a couple of years from now, send us pictures. We always love to follow up on our listeners' suggestions.
So anything that goes in will need summer watering, even in Monterey, probably thorough watering once a week, right? At the base, you know, right in the basin around the plant. So you could do it by hand if you were so inclined. If it were mine, I do it by hand shortly after I plant them and for a few weeks. And then at some point, a 1/2-inch drip line, which just hooks up to a hose, goes right next to each plant. And each plant gets 2 2-gallon an hour emitters so that I don't have to run the thing forever. In your soil, you may want to use lower output and further apart. You'll have to play it by ear, depending on whether your soil absorbs water. I think you said it's sandy, right? Where does it say here? Sandy soil. Yeah, so water is going to go straight down. So you'll need to make sure that they're close enough to the root zone that came with the plant, the nursery root zone, you can call it, that they'll get the irrigation they need. You can run that once a week, real thoroughly, couple to, you know, 3-4 gallons of water all at once. More is fine. And gradually back off from that as they get established and leave that system in place so that in subsequent years, if we have a dry year, for example, or you have an unusual spike of high temperatures, or you just want things to grow a little faster, every couple to few weeks, you could run it for a very long, thorough soaking and give them the water they need. Your first emitters would be many, many feet away from your oak tree. So again, as I said before, I'm not concerned about that, but do be aware that they will need irrigation during the first summer of establishment. And most of these are plants that would benefit from irrigation periodically, though infrequently in the future.
Usually I have a garden quote for you. Today I've decided to have 3 because they go so well together and they're all so short.
Okay.
Let's start with Confucius. Choose a job you love and you will never work a day in your life. Ben Franklin said, sloth makes all things difficult, but industry all things easy. And then we get to Will Rogers. And he said, what this country needs is dirtier fingernails and cleaner thoughts.
Okay. So we just went from Confucius to Ben Franklin to Will Rogers.
That's right.
You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore
and Lois Richter at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.